On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's a call out to American fans of Indian food. After you've enjoyed your samosa and chicken tikka masala and maybe a curry and some gulab jam, Chitrita Banerjee wants you to know there's a much bigger world out there, a universe barely touched on most Indian menus in America, of rich and varied cuisine from the subcontinent. We tend to eat the flavors of the North and Punjab. Banerjee wants to take you on a tour of Karnataka and Goa, Bengal and Amritsar to taste the food and learn a nation. Up next On Point, spread your banana leaf. We're eating India. Joining me today in the studio is Chitrita Banerjee, food writer, longtime expatriate in the U.S. and beyond, and native Bengali in northeast India. Her latest book is Eating India, an odyssey into the food and culture of the land of spices. Chitrita Banerjee, it's so great to have you. Thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Wonderful to have you here. So get us centered on your argument now. Paint the picture of what it is that most Americans are likely to consume when they go out for an Indian meal, and put that speck in the context of what it is and what it isn't in terms of the whole tapestry of Indian cuisine for us.
Well, as you said, most Indian restaurants will be serving the kind of food that you mentioned, which is based on northern Indian cuisine, mostly Punjabi cooking. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is that people started out with a few items of an unfamiliar cuisine and served them in restaurants. And when they became popular, the restaurant owners and chefs naturally wanted to stick to that.
Let's do more of the same
formula.
Right?
Yeah. And that
so dishes like what that would be part of that northern or Punjabi menu?
Yeah, I think the chicken tikka masala that you mentioned, the tandoori chicken, which is almost synonymous with Indian food in many minds here, and the roti and the naan and the kebabs, all those things, and some vegetables perhaps, the gobi alu, the matar paneer, the saag paneer, those things, and some dal, you know, dal makhni,
course,
maybe is
lentils,
a common dish,
yes,
a lentil dish. And then the usual rice pudding for dessert.
Right,
that also is a common item.
So this sounds like maybe the most common Indian takeout order in the country.
Yes.
When you look at it as an Indian expatriate, just how narrow does it look to you?
It is incredibly narrow. India is an enormous country. It has numerous regional cuisines that are very well developed with separate identities. Mm-hmm. At the same time, India is a very modern country with a lot of internal migration. And historically, it has had many people coming in from other parts of the world who have contributed, you know, their ideas and ingredients to cooking. So there is an incredible richness and depth to Indian cooking, as well as regional variety. And you can't even begin to measure that if you just go into a restaurant and have these few items to eat.
You've really opened up for me in your work here just how effective some plates of food could be in outlining a country's history and culture. I mean, you can dig down through that each dish and find roots that go, as you say, all over the world there.
That's right.
But you're also really opening up in your writing just the sensory pleasure of this food in your own Bengali background.
Yes.
There's a little bit I wonder if you'd read early on in the book. You're talking about, and we'll talk about, you say this is a bit of a bygone scene, not entirely, but a bit bygone. When you're aunt got married. It was a good old-fashioned get-together with all the dishes that come with a big, big Indian meal, Bengali in this case.
Yes.
I wonder if you'd read that, just to give us a little beginning of the visceral pleasure of this kind of feast.
All right. My aunt got married at a time when ceremonies were conducted at home, not in rented halls. Nobody seemed to mind the chaotic upheaval of realigned spaces, the bumping into upended furniture, or the crowds of relatives milling around for days. The roof of my grandparents' large, rambling four-story house was converted into a kitchen and banquet hall. Under a red and white canopy, the guests sat in front of long trestle tables. Bengalis, like most Indians, have always eaten with their fingers. Instead of plates and cutlery, each person was given a banana leaf. Rows of tiny light bulbs strung up on bamboo poles illuminated droplets of water that lingered on the glossy surface of the leaf after it had been washed. On one corner of the leaf sat the discreet embroidery of a pinch of salt, a wedge of lime, and 2 green chilies. As the feast progressed and different items were served in the traditionally approved sequence, a tapestry of colors and textures came to life on the palette of basic green. The consumer became an actor in a painterly enterprise. Eating off a banana leaf was a vastly different experience from eating out of a ceramic, porcelain, or metal plate. Your fingers got wedded to the sensory connotations of flaky luchis, which is a kind of fried bread, soft vegetables, grainy legumes, and a fluffy pilaf, even as your fingertips interacted with the silkiness of the leaf. When the pieces of carp or betki or other fish swimming in a redolent sauce were ladled out, you had to quickly blend the pilaf with them, lest the sauce run away to the edge of the leaf and spill over on the table. As for the pièce de résistance, a Malay curry of enormous freshwater prawns, the green banana leaf provided a perfect foil for a mélange of hues. Scarlet-orange shells covered the heads and tails of the prawns, contrasting with their pale flesh. The sauce that covered them was ruby red, gleaming with richness of spices, coconut milk, ghee, and the coral oozing from the heads.
Chitrita Banerjee reading from her new book, Eating India, and we're right there at your aunt's wedding, and what a feast. And you go right on with these, sweet and sour chutneys, with what you say, they're glowing with deep jewel tones, and the orange-flecked gold of darbesh with the mace and nutmeg. I mean,
yes.
We're right in the banana leaf, and
yes.
The fingers we're using to eat right here, yes. There's the sensory experience. Very, very rich.
Yes, and it really is something that has stayed with me, you know, for all these years. I haven't had a meal on a banana leaf in the United States. And I've been living here for so many years.
Yeah.
But it is something you never forget because it is so sensory, so immediate, and it sort of engages you on so many levels.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was lucky enough to spend a year or so living in India. It's old stomping grounds for me, and mm-hmm. nothing like that big banana leaf spread out. And then as you write here, when you're eating with your fingers, and for many Americans, this is like, what?
Yes.
But it's all so much more intimate, that sort of wonderful velvety texture of the leaf and
yes.
the food, and it all comes together there. Take us. We're going to take a kind of tour of the continent and its history along with that. But start in your home turf,
mm-hmm.
Bengal.
Mm-hmm.
What makes the cuisine there distinct from any of those that surround it or much further afield?
Well, there are two elements. One is the love of fish, but freshwater fish.
Right.
Bengalis love fish. Whereas in America, when you speak of fish, you're always thinking of seafood. And
mm-hmm.
that, you know, there's a major difference in taste.
Of course, Bengal full of rivers and rivulets.
Yes,
and
that's
the
right.
The
geography
of the,
makes
Ganges.
It, you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Thousands of rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And even little canals are teeming with fish,
mm-hmm.
especially during the rainy season,
mm-hmm.
which is now, right
mm-hmm.
now.
So that
the monsoon
mild
is there.
Freshwater fish coming
yes.
up through the monsoon.
That's right. And small fish, little,
mm-hmm.
you know, big fish,
mm-hmm.
All kinds of fish. Though I have to also add that the environment has been affected by some of our
pressures
decisions.
Of population
exactly.
and industry and all the rest. Nobody's
yes,
immune.
Exactly.
Yep.
As everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so the quality and quantity of fish is, you know, affected too.
Mm-hmm.
So rice and fish is the very basic Bengali meal. But the style of cooking is very different. In the northern Indian food that you see in restaurants as well as, you know, in people's homes,
mm.
The cooking has much more of, you know, spices, much more heavier elements like onion and garlic,
mm-hmm.
and also a lot of, you know, tomatoes are used. Whereas in Bengali cooking, a lot of it is, first of all, the flavoring that's important. So mustard oil is our favorite cooking medium.
Mm-hmm. A little more subtle flavor there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, I would say a little more pungent flavor.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and the pungency cuts the fish.
Mm-hmm.
Fishy
I see.
Flavor.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. The Bengalis love that.
Mm-hmm.
But we use mustard oil to cook vegetables also.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some recognized spice combinations which you put into the hot oil and it lends
Let's
it,
hear them. Like what?
There is the Bengalis' favorite spice combination is, of course, panchfuron, which literally means 5 flavors.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a mixture in equal proportions of mustard, fennel seed,
mm-hmm.
fenugreek,
mm-hmm.
those, you know, very funny looking seeds,
mm-hmm.
and cumin,
mm-hmm.
and nigella.
And the last is?
Nigella,
what
which is black, looks like black sesame seeds.
Right, right.
But if you put it in hot oil, it sort of releases a distinctive kind of onion-like flavor almost, which is why some people call it onion seed. It has nothing to do with onions.
And an aroma to go with it. Now, if I walk into a Bengali kitchen or I walk into a Punjabi tilted restaurant, let's say in North America somewhere, is it a very different aroma then in the kitchen?
Oh, definitely. Unless the Punjabi kitchen has decided to experiment with punch poron that day. Anybody can experiment.
Right.
But that is one very favorite spice combination that Bengalis use. And many vegetable dishes are cooked with little more than that spice combo and a few chilies.
Now, looking on as a girl growing up in Bengal, can you remember when cuisines from outside of your region first hit your palate? Did they taste foreign, different, identifiably outside your ken to you?
I would say that probably the very first time I tasted, you know, that kind of cooking, like tandoori cooking, was when I was already a college student.
So you would have gone all that time?
All the time,
and
yes.
And never hit tandoori.
Well, partly because when I was growing up, eating out was not such a common thing.
Yeah.
You ate at home. Yeah. And I happened to grow up with a fabulous cook, my mother. So we were not very tempted. But also, the social norms were that for entertainment, people invited you to dinner and they cooked for you. So you were not really having restaurant food.
We're talking this hour about the great bazaar of Indian foods, the tapestry of cuisines on the Indian subcontinent. My guest is Chuchita Banerjee. Her new book is Eating India, and she takes us right through the sort of time and space of it, through the geography and the history that brings this cuisines to life. Let's take a call from the American South, Savannah, Georgia. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a great lover of Indian cuisine, and I used to live in Italy, and I knew there was some great differences between the cuisine of southern and northern Italy. And I was wondering if there's that marked difference in the Indian culture of the between the northern and southern cuisine. And I was also wondering if there was any parts of India that where they consume beef.
Beef, got it. Chitrita, what about it? North and south, that's a great big divide, even in India. Talk about it.
That is a great big divide. The northern cuisines are probably what you see represented in restaurants here, though some restaurants are now experimenting with presenting southern food. And the southern states, they are probably most notable for very inventive uses of lentils and other kinds of legumes. But it's also a mistake to think that the southern Indian cuisines are all vegetarian, which a lot of people seem to think. The state of Kerala and Karnataka have, you know, very interesting meat dishes, meat recipes. And you asked about beef. Well, India is a land of many religions, and it's only the Hindus to whom beef is really forbidden.
Because the cow is sacred.
Because the cow is sacred. Otherwise, Muslims eat beef. They have no problems. Christians eat beef. And there are a lot of interesting beef dishes when, you know, you see them cooking. However, there are some other religions that generally avoid beef, partly out of deference and friendliness to their fellow Hindus. The Parsis, for instance, are very inclusive in their cuisine and their food. They have wonderful dishes, but they generally do not make beef in their home kitchens.
You're right. The Indian South carries an aura of distinctive identity, culture, and mythology comparable in its specificity to that of the American South. And you're looking there, as you say, at Karnataka and Kerala, Tamil Nadu, Andhra Pradesh, where I was lucky enough
That's
to spend
right.
a good deal of time.
Mm-hmm.
Not just culturally and cuisine-wise, but your reference there to meat does take us back. I mean, we begin to see the history emerging here. Meat coming in more or less with the Mughal, the Muslim invasion from the north, as you write it, centuries earlier.
Well, that is not entirely true, because in the ancient Indian epics, there is a lot of references to meat, mostly game, you know.
Yeah.
The royalty in particular, you know, hunted
of course,
deer
out
and
for the
boar.
Deer, yeah.
Yes, that's right. And they ate them. There was no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the chicken, of course, was not a common item, but other game birds were eaten. So meat in different forms has always been there. But I think certain styles of cooking were introduced by the Muslim invaders, and that changed eating habits and eating preferences, and certainly the frequency of eating meat in India.
And what about the sort of fire of the food, just how hot, the tang of it, north and south?
Southern food is generally hotter.
Sometimes way hotter.
Way hotter, that's right, as you yourself have experienced,
I'm sure. Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that we think of Indian food and chilies almost synonymously, and that is something that's been there for 500 years. It's the Portuguese who introduced the chilies and the potatoes to India, two items without which today no Indian can eat.
Right, absolutely not. Take us to that. I mean, it's a part of your story. As you say, many waves of people come and
right.
many stayed. Portuguese really through Goa in
southwest
India.
Southwest India.
Give us the history of Goa and how that showed up. And really, there was an India without chilies?
There was an India without chilies. If you read the narratives, you know, food narratives of the medieval period, you will find descriptions of food, very detailed descriptions of how to make dishes, where the heat, so-called heat,
right.
is supplied by ginger and black pepper.
Nothing more than that. Pretty
Nothing
bland, as you
that.
Described.
Black
you
pepper
it.
Was the black gold, but it was also
right.
the heat.
Right.
You know, that was the only thing we had.
Of course, Europeans were thrilled when they finally found pepper. But,
absolutely.
But compared to the chili when it comes to heat, that's nothing.
That's nothing. Absolutely nothing. And then, you know, Vasco da Gama came to India and landed on the coast of Calicut in Kerala, and he was looking, as they say, for spices and Christians.
To make some Christians and bring some spices, maybe.
Well, he had heard of some mysterious Christian empire, the people of Prester John.
Yeah.
That was all mythology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they brought in the chili pepper from their Latin American, you know, areas where they traded. Mm-hmm. And they introduced a whole host of other things, which were from South America and Africa, both places where they had already established themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cashew nut, which is so popular in India, came from Africa. The guava, something that they brought in.
Guava juice everywhere, cashews everywhere. It's hard to imagine India without them.
Exactly.
That nice little cone of cashews rolled in newspaper on the
that's
street.
That's right. With spices on
with
them.
Curry powder. Why don't we put curry powder on cashews here? I don't know. Come on, somebody do that.
I know. They're only doing it sweet cashews.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Let's take a call from Framingham, Massachusetts. Aaron, you're on the air with Chitra Banerjee.
Hi, thanks for the great show. I have a couple of things to point out. First of all, I grew up in upstate New York, and in the 60s and early 70s, my mother was experimenting with Indian food, so I was an early convert in a place where strange ethnic foods were not to be found.
Yes, I can imagine.
I live in Framingham, which is a town that has quite a few Indians from all parts of the country.
Yeah.
And one of our favorite restaurants specializes in southern Indian food.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of our favorite dishes is something called a dosa,
mm-hmm.
which I have never seen in any other Indian restaurant. And I was hoping that your guest could comment on the dosa and its various forms and its origins.
You're opening up a great big dish there,
yes, indeed.
Aaron. Give us dosa.
And I have to say right away, dosa is one of my favorite things. It is actually a crepe made from a batter of rice and a kind of lentil called urad dal, which is fermented. And there are many different kinds of dosas, which vary in size and texture. But it's basically like a pancake, you know. It's a very thin pancake, and you can make it and eat it plain with some chutney on the side, or you can put fillings inside, you know. Mostly it is a vegetable, potato and tomato and peas that you can put in there, which is called a masala dosa. But I should also tell you that you know, dosas are available in restaurants in Boston and Cambridge also these days, which makes me very happy because it shows an increasing and more sophisticated awareness of Indian food, which the restaurants have also, you know, woken up to. And they're serving them, and dosas are being eaten by Americans.
And no doubt, right across the country, if you know where to go and what to ask for, I'll never forget my first, I think it was the Woodlands restaurant in Madras, or
yes.
Chennai.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of an unforgettable moment there. Aaron, thanks for that call and enjoy. You remind us that Indians are really into sweets, and I wonder if you'd read a little bit for us on that front. I mean, the variety and the intensity and the splendor of color, just to begin, are something kind of incredible. Could you read a bit?
Sure. Sweets are a major part of eating in India. North to south, east to west, the subcontinent is one gigantic sweet tooth, constantly demanding gratification. Not only are sweets eaten as dessert to conclude a meal, as they are in the West, they can appear right in the middle of a meal in areas like Gujarat and Rajasthan, be served at breakfast and at tea time, and be eagerly consumed as snacks at any time of day, as candy is in the West. The extensive availability of street food in Indian cities and towns plays into this. Morning and afternoon, confectioners can be seen frying jalebis, descended from the Arabic zalabiya, and imratis, crisp yellow and orange sweets made by squeezing lentil-based batter into hot oil in convoluted patterns and soaking the resulting fried pieces briefly in syrup. As for sweet shops, while Calcutta appears to have the highest ratio of number per square mile, every city has more than enough to destroy the willpower of the moderately abstemious passerby. Home cooks contribute their portions to the family, rice pudding being the universal favorite, followed by a variety of laddus, crepes, and steamed confections. Even the gods love sweets, which are the commonest food items offered during the rituals of daily worship. Traditional Bengalis of my grandmother's generation firmly believed that it was unhealthy to drink water on an empty stomach. The remedy was to pop a sweet into your mouth before lifting the glass of water. If no proper sweets were available, there was always the ubiquitous batasha, a spun sugar bonbon of meringue-like texture.
Chitrita Banerjee reading from Eating India, with that great Indian sweet tooth on display right there. All the colors, all the flavors. In my old Vizag, Vishakhapatnam, is barfi. You know that,
barfi, that's right.
I mean, whoa, that stuff is dense and rich. And sometimes even with a little gold on top, as I recall, when people got really fancy.
Yes.
Flakes
that's
of gold.
Yes. Gold foil and silver foil very common adornments.
Right. Talk about rich. That's very rich food. Let's go to Samuel in Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Samuel. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I'm
wonderful.
Enjoying the show very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to India in August for a month.
Lucky you. Take some cool clothing, Sam.
I will try. I'm going to be in Dharamsala and traveling up to Leh in the Ladakh region.
Way up north.
I'm wondering if your guest could talk about the foods native to those regions, and particularly about the influence of the presence of the Tibetans and what the impact, if any, that has had on Indian cuisine.
Chitrita.
Well, I can't say that I've been to Dharamsala, so I will not be able to tell you exactly what is eaten there.
It's but a big country.
It's a big country, indeed. And I'm looking forward to making many more trips. But one Tibetan item that has become very popular, not just in Dharamsala, but in other cities like Calcutta, is the momo, which is a dumpling filled with meat and spices and absolutely delicious. It's a steamed dumpling that is served with very, very hot chili condiment on the side. And you dip into it and eat it like a savory dumpling. And it's absolutely delicious. And that is one Tibetan item that I do personally know about.
Samuel, that's one to put on your list. Take us across the other way. We spoke briefly about the arrival of the Mughal and the Muslims into this subcontinent. What about the impact of that along the lines of your immigration and invasion theme as they have driven Indian cuisine?
Yes. Well, as I think I said before that one result of that was the greater variety of meat cooking that came into India. The different influences that came with different Muslim conquests were all amalgamated and also probably, given a unique Indian touch over the years. But the custom of, making biryani, which probably is one of the commonest things that you hear about Indian food.
Describe it for those who don't have it on their menu.
It is a rice pilaf, but it is pilaf usually combined with meat. Very fancy
little
cooks.
Little bits kind of work through it.
Work through it, yes. That is also considered a part of, one result of the Muslim conquest and Muslim influence, because the Muslims came and they ruled India for many years until the British took over, practically. And certain ingredients that became more popular because of this. One can mention, you know, saffron, which was very popular in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mughal rulers of India became very fond of dishes that contained saffron. And under their patronage, you know, saffron cultivation in Kashmir became, you know, very, very popular.
So the Persian thread is woven
yes,
in
the
there.
Persian thread was one thread.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, the making of kebabs mm-hmm. and the eating of different styles of very rich meat with, you know, ground up cashews and marinating meat in yogurt. All of those things, I think, we acquired from the Muslim people who came in.
Mm, so it's an enormous tradition. It goes in particular to the imperial palaces.
It goes into the imperial palaces. And they were, you know, very rich cuisines that evolved out of that. But there was also a lot of variety in them. And for instance, the Mughal rulers were very fond of a sweet and sour taste in many things. And so the chefs learned to use, you know, syrup and lemon juice together in many dishes to lend them that taste.
And there's the sweet and there's the
yes.
sour of it right away. Let's go to Barnstable, Massachusetts, and Linda. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is,
Linda, you're breaking up on us, but I see a little summary here. It says, asking about foods associated with life points, birth, marriage, sort of passages in life. Linda, I'm sorry we lost your cell phone there, but Chitrita, what about it?
One of the things is, you know, rice is so important in India, throughout India, you know, everywhere. And
talk about throwing rice at the American wedding. Plenty of rice flying at Indian wedding.
That's right. Well, one life point thing that I can mention is a Bengali thing, which is when a baby is born, after the first 6 months, we have a ceremony that's called the first rice ceremony.
Mm.
And the baby is usually put on the lap of its maternal uncle. And this is the first time that the baby is going to have any solid food.
Solid food, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the first thing that he gives his baby is, you know, mashed up rice.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very important passage indeed.
Mm. You mentioned your aunt's wedding earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it just abundance that comes with the wedding, or is it a particular stripe of food that you're likely to see at that moment, that celebration?
No, it's not a particular stripe of food. It's really depending on your material circumstances.
Sure.
Traditionally, you're supposed to have as abundant and as elaborate a meal as possible.
Mm.
And in Bengal, the ideal meal, in theory, is supposed to be one that consists of 64 dishes. I mean, nobody can serve 64 dishes anymore.
Yeah.
But you see where they're coming from.
Mm.
So depending on what they could afford, traditionally, the Bengali wedding would have many different items that would cover, you know, rice, vegetables, fish, and meat, as well as sweets. And yogurt is a very auspicious item. This is another thing. Whenever you're undertaking something, you pray to the gods, obviously. But very often in many families, they will put a little dot of yogurt
mm-hmm.
on the forehead
mm-hmm.
as a sort of auspicious thing that will protect you and cover you and bring you success.
Now, as the botu, the kind of red spot, or an addition?
No, in addition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the red spot is either adornment or signifying that you're married.
Your marital status,
yes,
otherwise.
And
yep.
it is a woman thing.
Mm-hmm, of course.
But the yogurt spot can be worn by a man or a woman, depending on, you know, who's going to do what.
Well, we've got a lot more turf to cover here. One thing we didn't get to, speaking of Muslims and the North, but cheese and the history of cheese and its introduction to India. Now, so many dishes, in one form or another, it's there. We're not talking Swiss or Gouda here, but how did that show up, and why wasn't it always there?
Well, as always, you know, there is some mystery in the story, but what historians have speculated and what seems to make sense is that probably the Muslim invaders did bring with them the custom of eating paneer.
Mm.
And that is a term, you know, which is derived from the Farsi term paneer.
Mm-hmm.
And that is still very popular in northern India.
And on American menus of Indian food, the sog paneer is there.
The sog paneer and the mutter paneer is inevitable. Among Hindus in many parts of India, there was a sort of belief that since the cow is sacred and its milk is so holy, you don't really do anything to spoil the milk deliberately. So milk was processed mostly either by, you know, drinking it directly or by boiling it down, evaporating it to different consistencies, including almost solid, you know, fudge-like consistency. And that was made into sweets, of different kinds.
But the fermenting and the acid and everything that goes into cheese,
taboo? All of that was not there, yes. And yet, if you look at modern India, you suddenly find that, particularly where I come from, Bengal, is famous for sweets that are made with cottage cheese.
Oh, yeah.
And these are unique to Bengal. And that is a very curious thing.
You call it pantua.
Pantua, rasagulla, shondesh, you know, all of those things. Bengali sweet makers who have traveled and settled in other parts of India are making them. So I'm not saying that you don't get them out of Bengal. It's just that it's not part of any other regional cuisine in India. And one of the reasons that this happened in Bengal, the speculation is that it is connected to the Portuguese who actually migrated from Goa up and down the coast of India into the area around the Bay of Bengal and settled there. And these were not the imperial Portuguese. These were mostly ordinary people who were, you know, either soldiers of fortune or traders who wanted to just settle down and have a good life in a country that was far richer and, you know, easier to live in than Portugal. They didn't want to go back home.
At that moment, yeah.
At that moment. And so they settled down there, and they became very famous for making sweets themselves. Their, you know, pastries and cakes, I'm sure, must have been delicious and different. And other foreigners who came to India noted on it, including a French traveler, wrote about it, saying how famous they were. And I think it probably, what happened was that the interaction between the Bengalis and the Portuguese led to the Bengalis' awareness of their love of cheese. And they decided, well, maybe the taboo is not that important. Let's make some cheese and supply it to the Portuguese and make some money.
Right.
This is a new kind of business.
Right.
So, and from that step, the next step could easily have been some Bengali confectioner thinking, well, let me play with this new thing. What is it?
Right.
You know? And suddenly, after, you know, many, many years of not having these kind of sweets, you suddenly are awash in sandesh and rasagulla and pantua.
Right. Another fold in the tapestry right
That's
there.
That's right.
Sai is calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Sai. You're on the air with Chitrita Banerjee.
Hi. Well, I'm a chef, and I have a restaurant in Bristol, and I grew up cooking Indian food all my life at home, and I probably ate meat for the first time when I was, like, 19.
Wow.
But the interesting thing I find about it is, over the years, there have been so many rulers coming to India, and there's multiple layers of flavors which have added on to the regional food. And I find that very easily transferable to the Western style of cooking, using spices or the ingredient. Like, well, as the guest was saying, how the Portuguese in Goa use the vinegar, whereas in the rest of the India, it's mostly tamarind or lemon juice or green mangoes. And I find that very interesting in terms of how, you know, even the Mughal use of nuts as to make sauces and stuff like that is very, you know, what you call a much more richer kind of food.
Yeah.
And
Sai, let me ask you, you're a chef. Do you prepare Indian food?
No, I prepare more of Indian-inspired. Mostly I've trained in French and Italian, but I do use Indian spices in my cooking.
Wow, that's wonderful. So the fusion comes on strong there, and you hear how glad he is for the fusion that's already taken place in Indian cooking that informs
indeed.
It.
Yes.
Yeah, that's terrific. Sai, thanks very much for that. So let's go to Somerville, Massachusetts, and Chaim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great topic.
Good.
Wish you had time for me to stand for a long chat, but let me just ask, when I was a teenager and first becoming vegetarian, I got involved with a spiritual community of Indian origin, and I was intrigued by their avoidance of onions and mushrooms in particular and some other things, which they said they avoided because they embodied the guna of tamas. And I wanted to ask Chatterjee if you could talk about the influence of Ayurvedic thought on Indian cuisine.
The guna of tamas, you've got me there. What does it mean? Is it some kind of a dark energy? I don't know what.
Are you asking me or Chatterjee?
Yes, I'm asking you for starts, I guess.
Well, as I understood it then, there are three gunas, three kinds of energy. tamas sattva and rajas. Sattva is sort of the purest, the closest to holiness. Rajas is passionate and fiery, spicy foods, for example. Guna is darkness and ignorance. And so they avoided onions and mushrooms.
Wow, let us pick it up. Chidrito, what about it? The Ayurvedic traditions and their intersection with Indian cuisine. Chaim had them, you know, front and center on onions and mushrooms. No.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, mushrooms, of course, are not very common in India, but onions are, and so are garlic. And both of those have associations of, you know, what he's saying, the dark energy in mm-hmm. traditional thinking. Mm-hmm. Ayurveda is actually very interesting because it attributes specific qualities to specific foods. And I've mentioned that in the book. You know, different vegetables are supposed to be either cooling or hot, mm-hmm. and you eat them, therefore, in different seasons.
And different spices
and different the same. Spices mm-hmm. are the same. Mm-hmm. Onion and garlic are not technically spices. They're alliums, mm-hmm. but still, you know, mm-hmm. they fall into that category, too. In mm-hmm. the Mahabharata, which was, you know, written so long ago.
The great sacred text and narrative
text
there.
Sacred text and mm-hmm. epic of India. Mm-hmm. You have mention of, you know, a guru telling a student not to associate with women from a certain part of the country, which is, you know, up in the northwest, but I don't know exactly where, mm-hmm. because they are not pure because of their love of garlic. And in Bengal, for instance, there is a very cruel custom, or used to be, that widows, after they lost their husband, would have to stop eating any animal food and become total vegetarians. But somehow the vegetarianism meant excluding onion and garlic and, you know, orange lentils and mm-hmm. even some kind of greens as mm-hmm. well as a few other things. So the association of dark energy maybe or libido, I don't know what, mm-hmm. With onion and garlic is very strong.
Yeah.
And, you know, prejudice also comes out in phrased in those terms. You know, some Hindus will often say that they don't wish to associate with Muslims because they smell of onion and garlic.
Oh, well,
you know?
I mean, lots of cultures meet that way.
We
smell as we eat,
exactly.
and the unfamiliar
and
is always.
And if you're cooking meat,
yeah,
you know,
right.
you need onion and mm-hmm. garlic. Mm-hmm. You know, they are very natural combinations.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Mm-hmm. Chaim, thanks very much for bringing that aspect here. Raufa is calling from Hamilton, Massachusetts. Raufa, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling really in praise of Indian food, having been a global development worker for probably 25 years. Mm-hmm. I have eaten fabulous and very different kinds of Indian food in places that I've lived in, like Swaziland, certainly mm-hmm. in Kenya, in Sumatra. One of my favorite remarks was the opening where you talked about eating the food off the banana leaf.
Yes.
I was kind of sitting in my kitchen remembering the civil servants club in Singapore where you can sit under fans and waiters serve food like this on banana leaves.
Indians traveled widely and took it with them so many different places. Was it translated differently depending where you had it, Raufa?
Well, you know, I think it also depended on whether you were eating from someone's home cooking or whether you were in a
sure,
restaurant
exactly.
or a small market side roadside stall or a, you know, purveyor who goes up and down streets. There's so many different levels of cooking. But I've really enjoyed the diversity and also the way with which India has taken its food as its own ambassador.
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty good ambassador, eh?
Yes. That it can kind of reach into that aspect of you, no matter what kind of work you're doing, whether you're, you know, a day laborer or whether you're an intellectual. You can sit and have a meal that has so much passion and so much flavor, and such beautiful use of vegetables and. You know, some of the real simple things of life, some of the most nourishing things.
And also all the complexity and the sustenance were right there with you, Raufa. Roll out those banana leaves. I'm ready to go. That's just great. Let's get another call from Hampton, Virginia. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. I can tell you're really enjoying it. And, in fact, you're making me hungry. I'm
When's lunch? When's dinner? When's lunch?
Yeah, I just wanted to relate my experience. I grew up outside of Boston, kind of came of age in the 60s and 70s. And I used to listen to some Indian music on the radio, and, you know, that was the time of the Beatles, and
right.
Ravi Shankar was teaching right. George Harrison to play the sitar. But I never really had a chance to try Indian food until some years later. I was in the U.S. Air Force, and I was stationed in England. and there were many, many good Indian restaurants there. So I had my first chance to try Indian food and absolutely fell in love with it. Well, now that I'm living back in the United States, and of course there are Indian restaurants, but not very many where I live, I try to recreate some of those myself. So I have a spice cabinet full of, you know, all the spices that your guest has been mentioning.
Yes.
Curry powders and the seeds and the coriander and cumin and nigella and everything. And it's just absolutely wonderful cuisine. And thanks. Great show today.
Well, wonderful. Just open that spice cabinet door and you're halfway there, Kevin. And thanks very much for that. You've talked, you write some about strands that come and some about strands that go. An interesting note here on the Jewish tradition in India. Not widely noted, though it's a huge travel destination for Israelis.
That's right.
Of course. But what's the origin of that? Where is it headed?
Where is it headed? Oh, it almost seems like it's headed for disappearance, and I hope that it won't happen, because most of the Indian Jewish community has now migrated, you know, to Israel and also to the United States and England and a few other countries.
While they were there in those long centuries, what had they brought? What strand of the tapestry?
Well, depends on the origin. Most of them came from the Middle East, and so they had their styles of, you know, cooking. And I mentioned that, you know, the Calcutta Jewish community, who are called the Baghdadi Jews, because the majority of them came from Iraq.
From Baghdad. Or around.
Mm-hmm. Yes, or around. And they have, you know, the style of making, you know, little meat dumplings, which you see in the Middle East, but it has been spiced up differently in India.
No doubt.
And indeed, they have ways of making chicken and fish. And because they very often have a problem with getting somebody to do the ritual slaughtering, they have almost had to give up eating other kinds of meat.
To make it kosher,
make it kosher, yes.
And then there's the fried potato history.
Yes, indeed. Is it like a
lutki or something else? Is it?
No, they're individual potatoes. They are not mashed up. They are deep fried in oil, but they're deep fried almost in a very gentle and long process, like steaming or boiling, except that the medium of cooking is oil. And by the end of it, when they serve it to you, the potatoes are very, very crusty on the outside, and you expect them to be hard. But it's only the surface that's hard, and inside it's creamy and soft.
Oh, now we're talking. But there's a strand that may be disappearing. Let's get another call. One more from Vic in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Vic, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
I own a small Indian restaurant in Harvard Square, and we've been cutting edge from the day we open, or at least we've been trying to be. And what my question to your great writer is, where do you see future of Indian food in the United States? What do you see besides the usual chicken tikka masalas on most of the menus?
Vic, it's a great question, and permit me to expand it just slightly. Vic asks about where the future of Indian food goes in this country. Love to hear your answer to that. But what about in India as well? You have thoughts there also. What about the future here, both here and there?
I think the future in both is rich and varied. I think more and more Americans are getting to know and love Indian food, and more Americans are traveling to India, and they bring back a taste for India's different cuisines, depending on where they go.
So a wider swath showing
up
on menus here?
And I think demand for different things. Like I said, you know, 30 years ago you couldn't get dosas in an Indian restaurant, but now you can get dosas in many Indian restaurants.
What else do you see emerging? What's the new dish that you think Americans are going to be flocking to next on this?
I would not like to comment on that.
Okay, I wanted to help Vic out here.
Predictions are difficult to make. And in India at the same time, you know, we have, of course, the superficial Americanization of food. We have the McDonald's and the Domino's and all these, you know, chain stores opening up.
And less cooking at home.
But at the same time, there is always a group of people who are very serious about preserving the food and culture of their country, and they're working to do that. So I really think that India will keep on achieving the balance it has always achieved, you know, taking in different strands from different places and creating something unique.
How do you make a Big Mac Indian?
A Big Mac
in the course of time.
You've
talked about how everything gets absorbed into this wonderful.
Yes, maybe it
will
become a wonderful lamb patty flavored with saffron and other wonderful spices.
Oh my
gosh. Everybody from America will say, "We want that here."
Bring on the Indian Big Mac. Well, it's a wonderful story. Gosh, thanks for the tour. Thanks for the history. Thanks for the banana leaf and the food right in our fingers. It feels so good. Do you think that'll ever come here? Can you see Americans Indians washing up well and then heading out to the banana leaf and eating with their hands?
I have difficulty seeing that on a large scale. Mm. Even Indians are not doing that.
Is that
much.
Right? What?
That's right.
Fork and knife?
Knife and fork.
Oh, but you lose that visceral, that feel for it right there. Well, it's a wonderful thing. Chitrita Banerjee's new book is Eating India, An Odyssey into the Food and Culture of the Land of Spices. It's been wonderful having you. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.